forest fires, wildfires, whatever you call them, they've been impacting more people than usual this year and making the news more than ever. In some ways, it's because, unlike most years, the smoke from wildfires has been floating down and hanging over major cities in eastern Canada and the United States. Toronto, Ottawa, Montreal, New York, Washington, D.C. This is new to us. While residents of Western Canada are used to smoke from wildfires making an appearance, even in the cities of Western Canada, it just doesn't happen in places like Toronto and New York. Now, all the attention to this issue has turned wildfires into a bit of a culture war issue of late, with one side arguing it's all climate change and the other arguing it's all arson, probably by those eco-terrorists. The truth? It's probably a lot more nuanced, and that's what we're going to try and get to today. Hello, I'm Brian Lilly. This is the Full Comment Podcast. Before we get to our next guest, a reminder to please, pretty please even, hit that subscribe button. Whichever app device you're listening to us on, hit the subscribe button. Leave a review as well. Share with family and friends. They will want to know all about wildfires too. So what is the truth on this front? Is this the worst year ever? Is it all climate change? Is it all eco-terrorists? Is it bad winds? What lessons should we learn? That's what Kenneth Green is going to try and help us with. He is a senior fellow with the Fraser Institute. He's also an author of many, many academic papers, and also the book, The Plague of Models, which looks at how computer modeling took over and, well, what would you say, Ken? Manipulated, downgraded scientific research over the years?
Disrupted is a good term.
Disrupted, okay. You've been looking at the newscast. You've been seeing the effects of wildfires across the country. As someone that's studied it, is it the worst year ever? Is it one issue that's driving it? Is it another? How do you react when you see this, both the scale of the fires and the fact that some people on either side of the extremes are trying to turn it into a political issue?
Well, of course, the summer is long from over, and therefore it's declaring it the worst year ever or not is premature. It's going to wait to be seen for what the actual number of fires and extent of fires are. And then, of course, it has to be interpreted in light of the natural variation we see in previous summers and previous years. But it's certainly a notable one. It's not going to be one of the lower ones, at least not according to what I've seen in terms of the historical record for fire number and extent in the last, say, 20 years. But it remains to be seen as to whether it'll set a record, and in which number, which area, just area extent burned, the nature of the fires, the number of the fires, the people endangered. There's a lot of different parameters to define worst of the year, worst on the record.
Obviously, there's a long way to go before the year is over. It hasn't stopped some people from making declarations that are wild with speculation. Are differences across the country, though, in terms of wildfires and how they're fought, how they start, all of that. Do you think, though, to my point at the beginning, that it's getting as much attention as it does is in part because the smoke came to us? The smoke came to the big smoke, and we don't normally get it. Other parts of the country are saying, why are you complaining? This happens every year. Well, not to us.
Well, I think so. I think a large part of it is where you live and whether you're accustomed to this sort of thing. I actually grew up on the West Coast, and we took it for granted. I grew up in Los Angeles, and it was taken for granted that essentially every summer, or late spring and early summer, everything in the vicinity would burst into flames. That's pretty much how things work in Los Angeles, right? It rains in the spring, the foliage grows, the foliage dries out in late spring. And then summertime comes on, the summer heat comes on, heat, air, concentration, heat, sunlight, and boom, you have fire and people in the vicinity, and you have fire. So I think if you're from one of these biomes or ecosystems where fire is a natural element to you and you grew up in it, then you think, well, it's a little worse than normal, but you're not suddenly, it's not changing your worldview asking, oh my gosh, what's wrong with the entire planet that we're having fires here or we're having smoke here? I think it does have a lot to do with your experience and your cultural background, your geographic background.
Let's talk about climate change. What role is climate change playing in this, if any?
Well, of course, this is my opinion and my interpretation of climate data, but I think, you know, it's been measured that there has been a warming of the climate in the last 50 years, the last 100 years. And that background level of warming has to be presumed to is changing the baseline or the background level at which, you know, it's going to produce the increased frequency of fires. That being said, if you actually look at the number of fires over years in Canada, and you look at the extent burned in Canada, those trends are not following along with the measured increases in climate overall global average temperature from climate change. And so what I would say is, while climate change is a real thing, I think the measurements suggest a milder warming than models do, which is a different story. But simply the correlation between the observed climate change and observed changes in fire number and extent, they're inversely correlated. The warming's going up, has been increasing, whereas the number of fires generally has been decreasing over time in Canada.
So we've been having fewer fires, less of the country burned. But this year, you know, appears to be going up. We'll wait for the rest of the season. But if trends continue, it's looking like it's a bad year. We have short memories. We tend to think, oh, well, this is really horrible. It's never been like this. And then you look at the stats and you say, well, actually, it's just like 5 years ago. How much of that is at play?
Well, I think that's a big problem. People do have short memories, as you say, and they're bombarded with information on a regular basis that helps to push some of their old memories into obscurity. I think you were commenting earlier on the fact that people are shocked at grocery prices and trying to figure out how to deal with them. I also grew up in recessions and learned how to shop from my mother during recessions. So having actual experience with these things does help, but people have a short attention span. And so they don't necessarily remember that these things happened 5 years or 10 years ago and that it was the norm, because memories are short and lives are complex. And so old memories get displaced by more recent ones.
In terms of the cause of the fires, it's interesting when you look at different provincial stats, and you'll see that in British Columbia, most common one for fires that they have determined how they started is lightning. In Alberta, it's often human caused, and Alberta's got great database going back to, I think one is 2006 to 2018, and then they've got another chunk of years before that in a separate one. But you go through, and it's human caused doesn't mean arson. I was going through, and they're very detailed at times in what caused it. And the one that caught me, and I thought, oh, I didn't think of that, was hot exhaust from an ATV. It could be that. It could be a campfire getting out of control. That's what I meant when I said earlier, different regions seem to have different reasons for why the wildfires are starting. It's not one size fits all across a country like Canada.
No, that's right. And I think, to use some quasi-scientific terms or some scientific terminology, you have to look at the proximal cause of the fire, the thing that ignites a fire, as opposed to the more the distal cause, which is what builds up the fuel for the fire. And I think there are differences in the proximal causes, like you said. In Alberta, it could be human cause, but that does not mean arson. It could mean somebody loses a lug nut on their truck as they're driving down the highway. It kicks off a bunch of sparks and starts a fire, or it could be somebody throws a cigarette butt out the window of a car that causes a fire. There are any number of things that can trigger the fire once the base of the fuel has been set, right? So you need to look at the two questions of what's the trigger to burst into flames, as opposed to what is the cause of the buildup of the fuel. And that the buildup of the fuel problem seems to be more systemic in Canada. The proximal cause of what triggers the fuel to burst into flames is more regional. Wind here, lightning there. Human sparks because of interacting with the environment in another place. Those are going to vary.
I want to ask you about that fuel thing in a moment, just to give some stats on the number of wildfires. This, according to the federal government, you go back to a year like 1989, huge number of fires, 11,000 they recorded. The year before, 1988, was about 2,000. In 2020, there were just a few hundred across the country. Last year, about 7,500. They do tend to go up and down with no rhyme nor reason. I'm sure that you would find it looking at weather patterns and other things, but the idea that we're on a trajectory one way or another, just doesn't hold water when you look at the stats.
Well, right, that's right. I think, and you know, climate is, we talk about climate change, and people have, that gives people this idea that there's some calm, stately progression to the climate, that it's on this, they see the lovely charts and graphs showing the climate on a progressive change, moving upward on a nice flat slope and everything, nice smooth slope. But the climate is extremely variable year to year, and there are a lot of chaotic elements to it. There are a lot of non-linear, as the scientists would say, elements to it that can't be predicted. And then, of course, science year fires in one year will affect the fires in another. If you have that really huge year where you've scorched vast quantities of forest, you're not likely to see the similar kind of fire in the same place for several years because no fuel, right?
In 1990. Yeah. So I said 1989. Actually, about sorry, I said 11,000. Just looking at the chart, it's closer to 13. It's an odd chart. But the next year, less than 2,000 wildfires. So talk to me about the fuel, because I remember interviewing people about this years ago, and they were trying to put some blame for the fuel in the forests. Started with California, but it was a concept expanding into Canada, that we were having a buildup of fuel due to forest management practices that said, just leave everything wild. Do you put any stock in that?
You know, it's actually, it's a great question. It's a great question. And it's one we don't really ponder too much. I mean, I too have been critical of forest management practices in terms of whether or not they can lead to more or less fires in the past. But there's a bigger question of sort of, do people accept that the downside of having such massively gorgeous boreal forests that we all love is that forests burst into flames? It's a natural part of the cycle of the ecosystems. And so the question is whether or not it's really less a question of, has the government mismanaged it, as opposed to, should the government have gotten into the idea of managing these things in the first place, to put themselves at risk of people pointing the finger and saying, you're getting this wrong. Well, is there a way to get it right? Hard to know. I mean, that really, it's a judgment call, because you have to decide, do we accept, look, we live on a continent that is heavily forested. North America is forests and plains. It's right. And
the odd city in between.
Yeah. With the odd city stuck here or there in the other place. But really, I mean, it's going to go through the natural cycles of boom and bust and burn and grow. And there's a limit to how much that can be controlled. Now, I do think there's a balance to be struck between actually managing ecosystems around the little spots we talked about, of development, cities and urban areas. That is a legitimate province, I should think, or provenance of government. And there can be questions asked whether they're doing that well or not. But you know, the bigger question of when you have continent-wide bursts of forest fires, I don't really know that it's an appropriate frame of reference to say, look, we want the government to have the power to be able to control that. I'm not really sure we do.
How would you, in an area of where you've got forest stretching from the far northern reaches of British Columbia down into straight through Washington State and Oregon and down into California. And you've got the same thing in the Great Lakes Basin around, the unpopulated areas of central Canada or central North America.
Well, it's going to sound unsatisfying to people who are either you know, pro-regulation or anti-regulation, pro-government or anti-government or whatever. But there are certain things that are simply beyond the scope of sane attempts to control. And I think continent-wide fire is one of those things, which is you figure out how to adapt to it. You figure out how to live with it. You try to figure out how to live around it. You try to figure out how to recover from it. But the idea that you can control it, and as we've seen with other even larger issues of human contagion, the idea that you can control them is the first mistake. So I think there's something to be said for the asking questions of, are we managing the adaptation, resilience aspects well? But, trying to poke point blame for continent-wide conflagrations, I think is kind of a waste of time.
Well, I mean, one reason to try and make sure that we're not dealing with such an abundance of forest fires is the fact that it's not very good for our health to be breathing this stuff in. I mean, Toronto had the worst air quality of any major city in the world, according to one group out of Switzerland that monitors such things. And those were against up against cities that you actually associate with pollution. So, you know, this is bad for our lungs. This is bad for long-term health if it continues. So are there things that can be done? If managing a forest that stretches, you know, either down the back of the Appalachian mountain range or down the through the Rockies and along that spine, if doing that is unreasonable and impossible, what can governments do to try and manage it? Because, you know, as well as I do, bad things happen. Some people will demand, I don't care how conservative or libertarian leaning people are, at a certain point they say, well, somebody's got to do something. What if anything can be done?
Well, that's a good question. And again, not to overly personalize this, I grew up with asthma in California and the smog and the fires, and I agree there, it's the dense levels of smoke are bad for people. It's going to trigger asthma attacks. It's not causal, but it will irritate asthma in people and other respiratory illnesses. No question about that, I think, at least in my mind. But the question then is, what do you do about it? And the question then is, if something is affecting my lungs, and also I would urge a little caution on saying, well, this is going to cause a lifetime harm. Short-term exposures are different than long-term exposures, so we need to be careful about that.
I mean, if it's ongoing,
if it was ongoing, yearly basis. If it was ongoing all the time at these levels, you would certainly want greater activity. But I think really basically advising people at this point in terms of if somebody says, well, the government should do something, I'd say improving advisory systems that say, if you're vulnerable, and vulnerable means these people, to make sure people are educated and know that they're going to be particularly vulnerable to, in this case, wood smoke in the air or forest fire smoke in the air, then you should take the following precautions. You should stay indoors, don't exercise outdoors, stay in climate controlled, to the extent you can, climate controlled buildings or facilities, things like that. But I mean, beyond that kind of advisory role, this is just not something that governments, they just can't do much about it, really.
Are there practices such as preventative burns or clear cuts that could be used to try and help alleviate some of this?
Again, this is mostly my opinion. I'm not a forester. I should give a caveat there. I'm not a forester. Have never cut down a tree.
Well, you grew up in California. You're legally not allowed.
I would not have been allowed to grow up. Well, besides, I was living mostly near the bottom end of the Mojave Desert, but so I've been cutting down some neighbor's tree more likely. But no, you're not really allowed to do a lot of foresting there. But I would say, you know, with regard to things affecting specific localities, in Los Angeles, for example, they have fire roads. They just cut fire breaks. You might want to use clear cuts to create breaks and wind breaks, as we do in the middle of the prairies and everything. You create wind breaks to stop the flow of free flowing of wind. To control fire affecting people in where they are gathered, sure, setting fires, backfires, control burns, barrier methods, highway construction and highway width and things like that actually can play roles. Waterways, you know, routing waterways, things like that. But again, at continent scale, I don't see that. I don't know that anyone has the knowledge. A libertarian would say that it's a knowledge problem. Who has the knowledge of what that fire level is supposed to be from year to year? Where it's supposed to be from year to year? What extent you think should be burned in that year versus what extent you think shouldn't be burned in that year? I don't think anybody has the knowledge to actually stick hands on and start managing that. So I would say local level, probably there's some good reason to think about it. Nationally, not so much.
All right. We'll talk more about who to blame and who people are blaming and whether they're right when it comes to wildfires when we come back. So Ken, we've talked about how governments can deal with it, what's causing wildfires in various places this time of year. What do you say to those people that are convinced that this is all being caused by their pet political issue? What do you say to the people that say, this is proof that it's all climate change? Let's start there.
Well, I'm a deep disbeliever in conspiracy theories and also grandiose pronouncements like that, assignment of blame to multifactorial problems. I think it's kind of a simplistic thing that it's either this or that it's either climate change or natural variability, or human effect, human action, or pyromania. I mean, it's likely all of the above are involved. Some level of background warming, some level of natural variability in forest cycles, some actual criminality, some government missteps, some industry missteps. I'm sure there's blame to go around, but I don't think any one group gets the prize for saying you did this.
So you don't believe there's a group of eco-terrorists coordinated across the continent in various places, speaking both French, English, and probably Spanish, that are lighting these forest fires to achieve political goals?
No. I have several laws, several anti-conspiracist laws. We could talk about it some length, but no, I generally do not believe in conspiracy theories like that for a whole bunch of reasons. However, which is not to say that I do not think there are some people who are setting fires. Some of the motivations may be ecological. They could be eco-terrorists. Some of them could be just run-of-the-mill pyromaniacs, which have always been among us. And there are opportunists that go out and commit crimes in the midst of any kind of disasters, whether it's an earthquake, fires, floods, tornadoes, hurricanes. There are opportunists who will go out and commit the crimes that they have a previous desire to enact. So I'm sure some of that is going on. But overarching conspiracy theories, no, I don't. I just generally don't believe in them. I don't believe people are smart enough to coordinate them. I believe that thieves do not have honor, and they would rat each other out. The incentives to rat out the other conspirators grow the bigger the conspiracy gets. So as somebody says, you know, you can keep a secret. Two people can keep a secret if one of them is dead. I don't think 100 people can keep a secret or 1,000 people can keep a secret. So no, I don't see broad conspiracies. I see multi-factors. So.
People keep pointing to there was a guy arrested. I think it was up by Cold Lake in Alberta, and he's been charged with 10 counts. Well, yeah, there's arsonists every year. I remember covering a trial of one guy outside of Ottawa in eastern Ontario. He was in a rural area. He was a volunteer firefighter. He would go and set wildfires and then show up on the truck to put them out.
Sure.
I mean, he wanted to be the hero.
Sure. There are stories like that. There are also stories of people, they see a huge fire season. Some business owner who's on the red, in the big in the red side of the ledger thinks this would be a fine time for his warehouse to go up in flames, and so you have some criminality involved where people set their own fires for nefarious reasons, prosaic reasons, pragmatic reasons, whatever. But again, I don't think that defines the. It would be what would be unbelievable was if you could gather enough of those kind of people together. And get them to work together to spread fires simultaneously across, 4,000 mile expanse of Canadian boreal forests. If they were that good at planning, actually, you probably should have made them your government because most governments aren't that good at planning.
The Trudeau government has wasted no time in using this as a political wedge issue. They have started to demand. Running an ad demanding that Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre show his climate plan, and they're using the news footage and headlines of these wildfires as proof. And they are making the definitive statement that this is due to climate change. And they do this on a regular basis. They claim that Lytton, British Columbia burning down was due to climate change as opposed to what I believe the official report was, sparks in the woods caused by a train. They just continually point to climate change, and then they don't come up with a solution. They say climate change is the problem. They don't have a solution on climate change. They just want to use it for a political issue. you've looked at the IPCC reports, as have I, and they, even when they raise the issue of extra flooding, extra forest fires, extra storms, they're not definitive on this in laying blame, are they?
No, they're not. And in fact, the deeper you get into the technical side of the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, that's a UN entity that is sort of the ultimate resource for all things climate change. The deeper you dig into the science of it, the more caveat, heavily nuanced and caveated it is, which is the tie between extreme weather of different sorts, extreme changes in rainfall, flooding, drought, fire, hurricanes, tornadoes, etc., are all very, very modest in terms of the strength of the correlation. Nobody actually knows, no one knows if any one specific set of events is caused by the long-term pattern of climate change, whatever you think that is. But yes, we have an unfortunate political dynamic now in which people seize upon a unpleasant event or an undesired event, disasters, floods, fires, and just flat out they attribute it to climate change as if it is, and move forward to use that to batter their political opponents over, you know, too much regulation, not enough regulation,
what have you. See, but even what you're saying here, that the actual report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change at the UN has low-level confidence, you've got some people in our political discourse now who would just say, well, that proves you're a climate change denier.
Yes, but they would have said that no matter what you say. If you're not agreeing with every element of the end point of the policy that they want, people call you a denier because it's a Holocaust. It echoes matters of the Holocaust. It's a casual and easy blood libel to throw at people. But really, that's really when you disagree with what they want as a public policy. If you actually look at what the science, look at the publications of the IPCC, they say, we, this body of scientists who are assembled to write these reports, assign only low or medium confidence into the idea that there is a relationship between increased fire weather, as they call it, they refer to fire weather, and
that is a very odd term.
Climate change. Fire weather to me is an odd term. I agree. It's clearly a term of art, but if you read the words of the group themselves in their technical documentation, when they're talking to each other, not to you, the public, and not through policymakers, this is what it says. So, there's no denying that.
So whether we're talking forest fires or a larger issue like climate change, do we need to have more nuanced discussions to get at better outcomes, better policies? Because I standing up and screaming, basically, it's the equivalent of walking around with the sign on saying, the end is nigh, or yelling, we're all going to die. I think people just tune that out.
Well, you know, not to be a negative old guy, I've noticed a distinct dwindling of nuance in society's discussion of policy matters ever since I got into the field in the 1990s. So I would be the first one to say, yes, we need some more nuance on these kind of issues. We need more rigor in our in people's understanding of sciences. We need a vast increase in science literacy in both the U.S. and Canada, around the world, really, because increasingly policy issues are turning on matters of science. And at the same time, if you want to see trends that are going in the wrong directions, our dependence in policy based on science is going up. Our actual science literacy is in precipitous free fall and going down. So yes, we need better discourse, more informed discourse, more nuanced discourse, more real world based discourse, and less theoretical and abstract and political. If I had a way to promote that, I'd be promoting it, but instead I write my little scribblings and publish them where I can, and we all hope for the best.
Well, yeah, I mean, part of it have to be getting away from the models that you wrote about in your book. Models said that we would have clear Arctic ice, 15 years ago, that we wouldn't have snow. anymore. We've been making such grand pronouncements that people just ignore what is a serious issue, but maybe it's been oversold to them and overhyped, and so they no longer care. Because, well, we were all supposed to be dead by now. We were supposed to be baking like it was, Canada was supposed to be like Southern California at this point.
Well, yeah, that's a problem. I mean, as I refer to some of the models, computer models are sweet little lies. They paint very pretty, very stark, very graphic images of reality that, in fact, have nothing to do with reality. As I try to explain, Mickey Mouse is a model of a mouse, but he has remarkably little to do with actual behavior of mice and the biology of mice. But people would rather watch Mickey than actually watch mice, and so. So models are a problem. People have fixated on them, and they have allowed their underlying level of science literacy to decline in favor of the quick hit of looking at the model chart output and going, "Oh my God, I can relate to this." Because humans are visual creatures, they're heavily influenced by that the immediate visual outputs of these of models in a way that they're not of the dry numbers you might give them in an Excel spreadsheet. Or a data table, or a chart that shows the numbers of fire frequency and extent over time. These things don't motivate them to the way that a big model of that we have the climate that shows this nice steady line turning relative, you're turning from green to yellow to flaming red, and then it's skyrocketing, and the world is bursting into flames. People are moved by these model outputs in a way that they're not moved by data, and that's unfortunate.
Well, I'm not sure what the answer is, but we'll see how the rest of this forest fire season goes. We'll see what it looks like next year. Perhaps this is the year that we burn all the underbrush, and next year there's next to no fires. Will we blame that on climate change or a lack of eco-terrorists? I don't know. Ken Green, thanks so much for the time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Full Comment is a post-media podcast. My name's Brian Lilly, your host. This episode was produced by Andre Prue, with theme music by Bryce Hall. Kevin Libin is the executive producer. Remember, you can subscribe to Full Comment on Apple Podcasts, Google, Spotify, and Amazon Music. Listen through the app, and of course, give us a rating, leave a review, tell your friends about us, email your Aunt May and Whitby. Thanks for listening. Remember, I'm on your side.